In this part of Focus, we'll be exploring the world of archaeology. And our guest for the program is Elizabeth Wayland Barber. She is professor of archaeology and linguistics at Occidental College in Los Angeles and is one of the world's leading authorities on prehistoric textiles. In fact, she is the author of a book that got a lot of positive attention titled Women's Work, The First 20,000 Years. This morning, we'll be talking about another book that she has written, something more recent, that explores an archaeological find that got some people in the field very excited back in about 1994 when it really first came to the attention of scientists and scholars here in the West. And this is a number of mummies that were found in a rather remote area of Western China, a place called the Uyghur Autonomous Region, also known as Chinese Turkestan. These were very well-preserved mummies, some of them as old as 4,000 years, mummies that would have been the contemporaries of some of the mummies that perhaps we are more familiar with that were found in Egypt. And there are a number of things about this archaeological discovery that fascinated scientists and people who investigate these sorts of things. One of the things that was so interesting is that they were found with some very well-preserved examples of cloth. And that's something that you just don't find. Ancient cloth you don't find very often because it deteriorates and conditions just aren't all that good in most places for it to survive. But it did and presents us with some very beautiful examples of weaving that go back a long, long time. But another of the things that interested archaeologists about these people was the fact that even though they were found in this part of Western China, these people were not Asian. They were Caucasian, which leads to some questions about how these people got there and what these people were doing back in the second millennium BC in Central Asia. A number of these issues explored in the book that we'll be talking about this morning. The title of the book is The Mummies of Urumqi, and it's published by W.W. Norton and has just recently come out. And our guest, the author of the book, Elizabeth Wayland Barber, is with us by telephone to talk about it. And as we do that, you're certainly free to ask questions. The number here, as always, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. At any point that you would like to join the conversation, you're certainly welcome to do that. Well, Professor Barber, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Good morning.
You first went to this part of China to take a look at these mummies, I think, in 1995.
Correct.
Was that you were invited to do that? Was that because of your interest in textiles?
Yes, that was because of my sort of rare expertise in ancient textiles. As you said, it's so seldom that they are preserved, that there aren't very many people around who study these things.
Mm. One of the things about the book and apparently about this find that is so striking, and you can see it in the color plates that are included in the book, is the examples of textile work and weaving that were found here. And I guess to me as a layperson, perhaps the most striking thing about it is the color.
Yes.
They're very, very colorful. And I guess one of the things that I would be surprised about is that the color would have remained even after a couple of thousands of years.
We tend to have the idea that ancient people wore only white because the Egyptians preferred to wear only white, and that's about the only other place where you get textiles and clothing preserved in great quantity. However, our data suggests that other people outside of Egypt were all wearing colored clothing from, maybe 1500 BC on down. The earliest mummies out in the Tarim Basin are wearing just plain kind of golden brown natural colored sheep's wool. But by 1200 or so, they are BC, they are wearing these magnificent colors. And part of the reason that the colors are preserved so well is that what preserved clothing, mummies and all, was the very salty sand of the desert there. And salt is a good preserver of color.
Hmm. These folks really seemed to enjoy their clothes, didn't they?
Yes. Yes, their clothing, the clothing from about 1200 BC on is really quite exuberant.
Perhaps you ought to talk a little bit more about what this place is like, just for folks who would not ordinarily be familiar with what this part of the world is like.
Well, today much of it is a huge trackless desert. The central part of the desert, the Taklamakan Desert, is viewed as one of the worst deserts in the world. It's even drier and less hospitable than the Namibian desert, which has been much focused on television programs. People have probably seen pictures of that desert or of the Sahara. It's much drier even than the Sahara. It's hundreds of miles of huge traveling sand dunes with no life whatsoever in the central part of the desert. In fact, the word Taklamakan, which is the local name for this desert, has a local folk etymology, which means he who goes in never comes out again.
Wow.
So it's really quite an amazing place from that point of view today, but it's clear that it was rather wetter at that time. Well, I shouldn't say wet, but it was less dry. It was not the sand desert and the stone deserts were not so extensive as they are today, because what the earliest cemeteries that we have there, which are from about 2000 BC, are full of, the graves are marked by multiple circles of huge logs that have been driven into the ground. Well, where are they going to get all that timber? That suggests that there were woods close by at that time, where now there's nothing but trackless desert for a couple of hundred miles around. So clearly it was much more clement place in those days than it is now. Hmm. But it was still a rather hot and dry place.
Hmm. And it would have, obviously, because these people were sheep herding people, they would have had to raise the sheep to make the wool that they were weaving into these textiles.
They must have had meadows, right. Fodder for the animals, right.
One of the other things, I guess, that's really very interesting to archaeologists about these people, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, is that they were not Asian people.
Correct.
They were Caucasian. So obviously these people came from much further west of where these bodies were found, and they, I guess, being nomadic herders, probably just simply
wandered there.
Yeah.
Exactly. That is the picture that seemed to come together as I sifted through all the data. One of the reasons I was asked to go and look at this material is that these people put almost nothing else into their graves besides textiles. So if we were to figure out their cultural connections, somebody had to be able to analyze the textiles and their connections. So that was why it was viewed as important for me to go out there. Now, what they are wearing, as you mentioned a couple of times, is sheep's wool. And they were herders of sheep. And sheep were first domesticated from wild sheep, which grow naturally around, in the area around Mesopotamia, which that area that most of us learned in fifth grade as the Fertile Crescent. And that is where wild sheep that are the ancestors of modern domestic sheep lived, and that is where they were domesticated. And the interesting thing about the sheep is that they, in the wild state, they don't have a woolly coat. They have a hairy coat like that of a deer. And it took several thousand years of inbreeding to come up with woolly sheep. They were domesticated to eat, not for the wool they didn't have yet. And so when we see woolly sheep out in Central Asia, they could only have come bit by bit, a few miles at a time. They had to have wandered over from the area around Mesopotamia, which today is Iraq. So we know from that point of view that they came from the West. We see from their Caucasian features that they came from the West. And the other thing that they lived on was wheat, which also was domesticated in the area around Mesopotamia. So everything points to their Western origins.
Hmm. In looking at their clothes and the way that they are made, does that tell you also something about who these people were and where they came from?
For the most part, their clothing is sufficiently simple that it doesn't tell us anything very specific. There is one interesting garment being worn by the earliest of the mummies, who wear the very simplest clothes. For the most part, they just have a huge square piece of cloth that they wrap around them as a, it serves as their shroud in death. It probably served as their blanket at night and their cloak during the daytime when they were alive. And they have moccasins. But under this great big blanket wrap, the one thing that they are wearing, the men wear a sash, and the women wear a kind of a belt band with a bunch of strings hung down from it. And that is a garment that we can trace in Western Eurasia, that is to say between the Urals and the Atlantic, starting back around 20,000 BC. And that, in fact, is where I got the title for my book, which you mentioned, Women's Work, the First 20,000 Years, because string and these funny simple string skirts are the first evidence that we have for human clothing. It starts about 20,000 BC and is the one garment that people were wearing back in the Paleolithic. So for these to turn up in Chinese Turkestan with the earliest people coming in from the West, I found very, very interesting. It shows that they probably came from a somewhat more northerly area than Mesopotamia itself. They must somehow, their ancestors must somehow have gotten the sheep and the wheat from Mesopotamia originally, but these people must have come in by a little more northerly route to have this European string skirt.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Elizabeth Whalen-Barber. She is professor of archaeology and linguistics at Occidental College in Los Angeles. She is one of the world's foremost experts on prehistoric textiles. She's the author of a book that deals with that subject that's titled Women's Work, the First 20,000 Years. So if you're interested in exploring that subject, you can certainly look for that book. And the one that we're talking about here this morning, The Mummies of Urumqi, is published by W.W. Norton. And indeed, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, it discusses a find of mummies that were discovered in a remote area of Western China, several thousand years old. These people would have been contemporaries of the ancient Egyptians, those other mummies that we're perhaps so familiar with. And one of the things that excited archaeologists a lot about this particular find was that there were a number of very well-preserved examples of cloth, textiles, and it's something that is very rare to find, something, a piece of cloth that is that old. And that was one of the reasons that our guest was invited to come and take a look at it, because that is one of her special areas of interest. If you have questions, you can call us, 333-WILL or 9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-WILL. I think probably some people who are listening to us would have had the experience of having visited a museum and seen a mummy, probably an Egyptian one. They have them in Chicago, and in other museums, and I think it seems that, to me, sometimes at least, a little hard to connect with that artifact as having been a living human being once, and I wonder
is definitely not the case with these.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because they are very striking to look at, and partly I suppose because They're dressed, and partly, you know, also because of the state of their preservation, it makes it somehow much easier to look at them, and see that this was indeed once a human being.
several of the mummies in particular look really much more as if they're lying there asleep. They're a little bit emaciated, but otherwise they just look as if they're lying peacefully asleep. And it was so interesting to watch when we were working there that visitors who would come into the gallery unaware of perhaps of what was in there would suddenly lower their voices and start to tiptoe, as one would if you were in a room full of people who were asleep. Hmm. They are remarkably well-preserved. The Egyptian ones look sort of wrinkled and dark brown, but these still have their natural coloration. The hair, everything, simply that the eyes are shut and the cheeks are somewhat sunken.
Yeah. And it seems that it's much easier to really look at some of them and imagine what that person really looked like.
Absolutely.
In life.
In fact, one of them, the oldest of the mummies from about 2000 BC, so 4,000 years old, is a woman with a very beautiful face. And she was sort of adopted by the local Turkic peoples. Most of the Uyghur Autonomous Region is inhabited by Turkic peoples today, with some Han Chinese who have come in as administrators and colonists. But the local Uyghurs, the local Turkic people, have adopted this lady as their ancestress, and a local artist had done a painting of how she probably looked in life. And you will see that painting on wall posters and CD covers of, you know, local Turkic musicians and so forth. They have really adopted her, and they have nicknamed her the Beauty of Lulan, Lulan being the area of the Tarim Basin where she was dug up.
Yeah, I think you reproduced that painting or a painting in the front piece of the book.
The front piece is actually a painting that I commissioned from a young artist in the Netherlands, Kelvin Wilson, who is a very fine archaeologist. He specializes in archaeological illustration, reconstructing, sort of bringing back to life what people looked like from a very close scrutiny of the artifacts. And in that image that I commissioned him to do for the frontispiece, you see the Beauty of Lulan brought back to life with all her clothing, her accoutrements. She has a small comb. She has a basket for wheat. She has a winnowing tray, which she is using in the picture to winnow the wheat. And in the background, there are sheep, which we carefully drew. I sent in many photographs of sheep who have evolved to the degree of wooliness that Bronze Age sheep had evolved to. And also an interesting plant that looks kind of like sagebrush or tumbleweed in the background that is called ephedra, which was found... It was one of practically the only other thing that was found in these graves besides the clothing and the baskets is this little pouches of this plant called ephedra, which most of your listeners will know in as being used today in such drugs as Sudafed and Actifed. And it's called, the chemical is called ephedrine,
mm-hmm.
And it is a stimulant.
It's very close to the natural stimulants produced by the body. Yes, maybe you'll know if you take one of these things. I don't particularly like the way it makes me feel, but...
Well, I don't think they were taking it. They might have been taking it as a stimulant, but just as a stimulant. It's known in this country, it was brought... To this country, it's known as Mormon tea or desert tea, and was used for a mild pick-me-up, like coffee. But it's used pharmaceutically today especially for asthma attacks, but I don't think they were putting this stuff into the graves to prevent the dead from having asthma attacks. I think that they were using it as part of a wider ritual to... helps the people get to the dead people to reach the spirit world. And that was because they used it, I think, this is part of my reconstruction, that they were using it as one of two drugs that they mixed together to produce hallucinations when they were alive in order to reach the spirit world to consult their ancestors. And this is a common practice even today, or into this century, I should say, in Central Asia.
I'm curious if you can talk about what, by looking at the cloth,
yes,
the textiles, and looking at the way that it's woven and the patterns and the, you know, anything about it, if looking at this thing that these people made, you can then make some assertions about them and about,
yes,
what they were like.
Well, the most spectacular and controversial of these connections is that one of the site that is most to the northeast, it begins about 1200 BC. There they have found colored textiles that are in the form of plaid twills, which is exactly what you find, for example, on a Scottish tartan.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody says, hey, how did the Celts get out into Chinese Turkestan? Because they look so much like the plaids that the Scots make today. Of course, that is not what's happening. It's not that the Celts made it out to Chinese Turkestan, but these people apparently are related. And trying to sort out that puzzle was one of the most interesting parts of the whole thing, and actually the one that caught my attention that made me want to go out there when they offered me the chance to do so. What seems to be happening is that both the weaving of twill, which is a weaving pattern, the way in which you manipulate your loom to make the cloth, and the making of plaid, which means you simply put stripes, color stripes, into both the warp and the weft, both sets of threads. Both of those technologies first turn up in the area north around the Caucasus Mountains about between 3000 BC and 2500 BC. Now, our earliest mummies turn up in the Tarim Basin about 2000 BC. Well, it takes a long time to traverse half of Eurasia. And it seems as though not the first group of people who, as I said, are very simply dressed in plain brown cloth, but the second group of people to make it out there seem to have come from this area around the Caucasus. They went eastwards from the Caucasus, and it took them a long time to get there. But at the same time, the group of people who were the ancestors of the Celts were headed westward from the Caucasus, and they ended up in Central Europe in the area which today is Austria, southern Germany, western Hungary. And there they left behind, at just about the same time as we find plaid twills out in Chinese Turkestan, immediate ancestors of the Celts were leaving plaid twills in the salt mines in Upper Austria at Hallstatt and Hallein. And Hallstatt, in fact, gives its name to this culture, which we know. So here we have plaid twills turning up at about 1200 BC in Central Europe and out in Chinese Turkestan. Well, one of the interesting puzzles that we have known for almost a century now is linguistic puzzles, is that there are Indo-Europeans who leave documents behind in the first millennium AD out in Chinese Turkestan of a language that is quite closely related to Celtic. So you can see the plot thickening.
Mm-hmm.
Here we have these so-called Indo-European peoples who gave birth to the Celts, also gave birth to these people that we know of as the Tocharians from their later inscriptions, but also gave birth to us. English is a Germanic language, and Germanic is one of the branches of this same linguistic family, Indo-European, as is Greek, Latin, Armenian, Slavic, Indic, Iranian. There are many branches of this, and they fill much of the eastern half of Eurasia. So it was fascinating to find all these little pieces coming together with the textiles with these plaid twills.
And by the way, if you're interested in exploring this subject of ancient textiles, you might also look for her book, Women's Work, The First 20,000 Years, which was published about, maybe about...
1994.
Okay. I was going to say maybe something like 5 or 6 years ago. So I guess I was about in the right ballpark there.
Right.
We have a caller to talk with, and others are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hello. The period you're describing is about the period that the Scythians dominated most of the steppes, if I'm not mistaken, isn't it?
Yes, they're just a trifle later, about 500-600 B.C., but very close, yes.
I thought it actually went back a bit before that, but they, of course, were a North Iranian people.
Right.
And a connection between the Tarim Basin and the North Iranian peoples would seem to be almost to be expected.
Absolutely.
I seem to remember reading a book by a French historian. I can't remember his name, but I know the title of the book, I believe, was The Empire of the Steppes. And he reports, of course, the Tarim Basin was part of the old Silk Trail.
Yes.
Silk Road, I should say. And there are reports of red-haired and blue-eyed people in that area as late as the High Middle Ages.
They're still there.
You run
into them in the bazaar.
It's much more Turkic people, so today, isn't it? Because of the Turkish migration.
That's true. But in the Uyghur Autonomous Region, specifically, you still run into people with blondish or reddish hair and often blue eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So that genetic strain is still there.
Of course, you see the blue eyes in Iran.
Ah, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Well, my wife is Iranian, and she definitely has hazel eyes. and of course, there are Iranian peoples north of Iran even today.
Yes.
But it's very interesting. But given the importance of the horse in the cultures of the Scythians, and I would assume the pre-Scythians, wouldn't it have been possible for these people to move much more quickly than one might suppose?
Starting about 1000 B.C., maybe even 1200 B.C., we start to see evidence for the horse. This most spectacular mummy that we were discussing earlier, the man with the wonderfully colored garments and the other people who were in the same tomb with him. There is a saddle. There is a horse head sacrifice at the top of the burial and so forth. So these people certainly did have horses. The first people who came in clearly did not have horses at 2000 B.C.
Probably not.
But the second and possibly third waves of people coming in around 1200 B.C. clearly did. And I think you're exactly right. This is, in fact, how I finally had to reconstruct it, that these later waves of people towards the end of the second millennium were coming in by a somewhat more northerly route and were coming in with the horse. And so they could move much more quickly once they got the horse. The first people clearly came in, you know, step by step, on foot, herding their sheep.
Did they seem to be Indo-European as well as the second and third waves?
Interestingly, the conclusion that I had to come to is that first wave of people who came in step by step, if they are speaking Indo-European language at all, probably spoke Iranian, some branch of Iranian.
Well, of course.
Whereas the second group of people seem to be the Tocharians, who are the ones that you referred to from the early Middle Ages as being found out there with reddish hair and hazel eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Those seem to be the Tocharians, this other Indo-European group. And they left, I have photographs of their wall paintings where they show themselves with those characteristics from about 1000 A.D., you know, 600 to 1000 A.D.
There are a lot of metalwork and I think even some leatherwork artifacts from the Scythians. Were there any fabrics from that group that survived? I suppose not.
They apparently had perhaps some taboo against putting metal into the graves. This was very strange. There is evidence from, for example, the way the logs are hewn, that they were using metal tools, but they put nothing metal into the graves. And the conditions are such that it should have survived if it had been there. There is maybe one pot, and everything else is textiles or an occasional bit of leather. But it's amazing how little they put into these graves other than just the textiles, just the clothing.
It is interesting. Well, I saw, I believe, a television program on NPR about the mummies there.
Yes.
Very interesting. And, of course, also the I believe it's a site near the Altai.
Mm-hmm. Right. Just to the north, the frozen tombs.
Yes.
Yes.
That's much later, though, isn't it? Early Middle Ages?
No. The frozen tombs in the Altai are about 500 B.C.
No, that's early.
So just before or just about the time that the Turkic peoples or Turkic and Mongoloid types of people start turning up visibly in the remains in the Tarim Basin. You find nothing but Caucasians from the earliest peoples who are about 2000 BC down to about 500 to 300 BC. That seems to be when we get the first Mongoloid and Turkic-type peoples coming into this area. And then the Chinese come in from the east about 100 B.C. And you can see these additional genetic components very clearly in the bones in the cemeteries.
Well, thank you. Most interesting.
All right. Thank you for the call. I just one little point that I think is kind of interesting. One of the things that I learned in reading the book that I didn't know, you were talking with the caller a little bit about the fact that there are these two groups of people, and the older ones seemed to be not people who were riders. They didn't have horses.
Correct.
These sort of later ones, like the Churchin man, the man that we've talked a little bit about, who was wearing all these very, very colorful clothes.
Right.
Probably was. And one of the things that you notice about him, although maybe we now might not think about it, is that if he's wearing pants.
He's wearing trousers.
And that apparently you think that the invention of pants coincided with when people started riding horses.
Exactly, to prevent unwanted chafing in their parts.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. The two seem to correlate very closely. Wherever we find trousers, it is because people have just taken up horse riding.
We have other callers, and let's go next to Martinsville, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hi.
Mm-hmm.
How much do the old legends come into play in your research of what you're trying to find out, whether it be your textiles or the origins of these people?
I'm very conscious of legends, and I have done as much combing through legends as I have had time to do. Often they can be very enlightening. Unfortunately, people became literate so late, relatively speaking, in this part of the world, that they're not likely to tell us very much about the mummies of 2000 B.C., by the time, or even, I haven't found much help for the mummies of 1000 B.C. By the time you get down to the mummies of 500 B.C. and the frozen tombs up in due north, several hundred miles due north in the Altai Mountains of 500 B.C., you start seeing all sorts of correlations with legends that have been preserved. Legends to do with horses, legends to do with, I remember from the frozen tombs, there's a huge pair of stuffed swans. They're made of fabric and they're stuffed. And there are many swan legends associated with this area and with these peoples. So So for the later material, the Scythians on down, yes, the legends are very helpful, but for these very earliest people, we don't seem to be getting much correlation. It's just too far back.
Well, what I was thinking of was directly west of where these Chinese mummies were found. In Turkmenistan, there's old legends, and evidently there's an old book that I've never been able to find. Evidently it's in Russian, but my Russian friends dismiss it as fairy tales. But the Turkmenis claim that all life originated from that desert. And 20,000 years ago, when that was Ice Age, probably that was a good grassland and good land. And, of course, naturally, when you conditions leave, you get bad for you, you just move. And I wonder, have you ever found out anything about this book or these legends?
No, I have not encountered that particular legend or that particular book. I would be interested in such a book. I do read Russian. But
believe it or not, these were Fulbright scholars who were telling me this.
Well, I will pursue it. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I'm interested in this as well. I'll let someone else come on. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We'll back again to another caller. This is Downs, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'm interested to know what you, if anything, you found out about loom technology.
Unfortunately, we have not yet dug up the habitation sites. All we have is a number of cemeteries at this point. Uh-huh. There was one spindle in, apparently a low-world spindle, in the tomb at the undisturbed tomb at Cherchen. But otherwise, one has to deduce what one can about the looms from the fabrics. And what is striking about the fabrics in that regard is that we never saw anything that was more than about 22 inches wide. It tended to vary between about 18 and 22 inches. And what that tells you is that you've got a loom that has a single operator who is working from one end who has to be able to reach around both sides of the cloth. So it is probably either, it might be a back-tensioned loom, such as you find today in Southeast Asia, where you tie one end of the warp to a bar on your belt and lean back in order to get the tension because you've tied the other end down somewhere else, or perhaps it was pegged out on the ground. But it is clearly being kept narrow because it is some kind of single weaver loom rather than something where you're passing a weft back and forth between two people on either side.
Right.
But that's about all I can say. There is no evidence of unique weaves like tablet weaving, the cording that you find with tablet weaving. There's no evidence of that and so forth. So we're just left guessing from what little structural evidence there is. Sometimes the fabrics have a closed edge on all four sides, which tells you a little bit about the... It almost certainly is not a warp-weighted loom.
Right.
But that's about all we can deduce.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. I have to say that I probably haven't thought very much before looking at this book about weaving, although now it's caused me to start looking at things a little bit differently. And it's really quite, I find it quite fascinating. I'm sort of a little surprised, in fact. But to me, I think one of the interesting things about it is this idea that, you know, how many human activities are there that you can engage in today that people have been doing for a long, long time? And I'm interested in this idea of continuity, that a weaver today is practicing this art and doing it in a way with perhaps minor differences that people have been doing for thousands of years. There aren't that many things that you can say that about.
No, that's true. And weaving is one of the oldest. The only one that beats it out is spinning. Spinning thread, where you take tiny little fibers that each themselves can break so easily and twist them together, and you can get this almost infinitely long string, which is virtually very hard to break. You can make things out of it. That craft goes back 25,000 years at least. Weaving we have proof for from about 9,000 years ago, but it already looks so beautifully done, they must have been doing it for a while. And pottery doesn't start until, no, so weaving we have proof at 7,000 BC, which was 9,000 years ago. Pottery doesn't begin till 5,800 BC. So weaving is older than pottery. Yeah. And metallurgy doesn't begin until about 3000 BC, smelted metals. They cold hammered them before that if they found pieces of pure metal, but that was very minor. They begin metallurgy in earnest about 3000 BC. So weaving is the oldest craft.
Hmm. Another aspect of this that I think about is that as you mentioned that you find in this place examples of very old textiles that are plaid twills that look very much like what we think of Scottish people liking, and of course that I mean now
right.
And that's very popular in clothing. So you see people going around with stuff like this
exactly.
Today, and a couple of the examples that are here in the book, they're very pleasing. They're very aesthetically
yeah.
pleasing, and seem to be in a way very sophisticated. And you start
yeah.
thinking that you could have woven a perfectly acceptable piece of cloth that would have been very functional and very good, and you could have done it all in one color. Well, you know what? I started thinking about who it was and why it is they started thinking. Well, you know, I just kind of like to have something a little bit. I don't want something that's all brown. Let's put some color in it. Let's put some stripes. Let's make the stripes go different directions. What about humans led them to want to have something that was pretty? I mean, in a sense, was decorative, was nice, and something that they must have, you know, admired on themselves, admired on each other.
One of the really interesting things to me about working with the history of clothing is that clothes began not for either warmth or modesty, but to show status.
Mm.
And the first status symbol that was shown was whether the woman was marriageable or not. It's hard to go around saying, I'm available, I'm available, I'm available all the time, or saying, I'm not available, I'm not available, I'm not available all the time. So you want to hang something on your body that says this so everybody knows. And that is how clothing started. If you were cold, you could grab a fur and wrap it around you. But clothing that you wore more or less permanently seems to have started for status. And I think the same thing is true for these patterned fabrics, that now once you developed weaving, the next step was to say, well, I could send my message by the form of my clothing, but I could also send it by the form of the pattern on the clothing. And so that is really the next logical step, and that is how you see it gradually developing in the course of the Stone Age.
Well, one of the things that I'm sure people will know about the tartan, the Scottish plaids, is that
right.
the individual patterns are associated with families, and it's one
correct.
Of those things where I guess the idea is that if you had met somebody walking along and they were wearing a particular tartan, you knew at least what their affiliation, you know what family it belonged
right.
to. What do you think it would have been the case even at this point that that also would have been a sign that different groups of people might have reserved different patterns or different colors or things to them as the same sort of a sign that it was kind of a uniform or a marker that said we all belong together and we're sort of different from these other people who live over there?
It's entirely possible. We have, since we don't have any written text, it's very hard to know for certain exactly what they made of it. The tartans that are associated with specific families in Scotland were sort of crystallized out as family patterns in the period of intense nationalism, particularly in the 18th century, in the 1700s. And people have assumed that because that was when the tartans were set family by family, that that's when they started weaving plaid twills. But we now know from the archaeological evidence they'd been weaving plaid twills for a long time before that, but you could just kind of make up any pattern you liked probably before that. However, so that's what we see in terms of the history of tartans among the Celts. But there are some other reasons to be wearing some of these colors. It keeps striking me that in the Hallstatt textiles, the proto-Celtic textiles, they are virtually always some combination of brown and yellow or brown and green. which strikes me as being very good camouflage if you're out hunting. And so I wonder if maybe one of the reasons for the particular colors and the breaking up of the solid color with those stripes may have had something to do with camouflage for hunting. Now, going out to the Tarim Basin, it is remarkable that this Chechen man and his family all wear rather similar fabrics. The last body to be put into this grave after the main tomb had been closed up was that of a three-month-old baby who was wearing fabrics that are almost identical to the man's. And so it suggests the baby is of the man's family. Now, is the baby dressed that way to show his lineage, or is it because that's what the family happened to have been weaving? And that's where we would have to have text to tell us which is the case. But it's clear that the family is mostly wearing things that come off of the same looms, that were dyed with the same dyes, and so forth.
There's so many questions that I think I would like to ask, and we're getting near the end of the time. One of the issues that you explore in the book is this issue of language, and
yes.
One of the questions that initially were asked about these people was, well, what language did they speak? And it seems that if you're dealing with people that before there was writing, this would be an almost impossible question to answer. Is it possible to talk a little bit about that, sort of in ways that a non-linguist would be able to understand?
It's a wonderfully difficult question. Yes, I actually have my PhD in linguistics, but I've been an archaeologist at heart since I was a kid. And so it's a wonderful challenge to try to match linguistic with archaeological data. It's a very difficult problem. But one of the things one can do is mine the place names. For example, in the East Coast, when the Europeans arrived, they borrowed all sorts of Indian place names. So you've got Massachusetts and Potomac and so forth. And you see the same thing in the West and probably in the Midwest. If you look at the place names that are recorded from the times at which writing first began in that area, when people first began to become literate, in the first millennium A.D., you look at what the Chinese say, record about local place names, what the other people who came in record, what you see is that if you can identify the original language of those names at all, it ends up being either Iranian or Tocharian. And that suggests that the people who were in there before the Chinese were either Iranian or Tocharian. That is to say, there were some Iranian people and some Tocharian people. So that's one approach, is to look at the place names that were borrowed by the later people who came in from the people who've been there before. Another thing you can do is reconstruct backwards from the more modern languages, and this is the more usual playground of historical linguists. So that, for example, the English word weave is a word that goes all the way back to the Proto-Indo-European community of about 3000 BC, and it's related to the Greek word for to weave and the Indic word for to weave and so forth. So you can triangulate backwards from this vocabulary. If everybody shares the same reflexes of the same word for weave, then the original community of people back at 3000 BC before they spread out had to have known weaving.
Yeah. I'm sorry to kind of interrupt you, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to do that because we're here at the end of the time,
right.
And just we'll have to stop there and to say thanks very much. It's a fascinating book, and I appreciate you taking some time to talk with us about it.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Our guest, Elizabeth Wayland Barber. She's professor of archaeology and linguistics at Occidental College in Los Angeles. And again, if you would like to look at the book we've mentioned, it's titled The Mummies of Urumqi, and it's published by W.W. Norton.